Hi, my name is Michael Kramer, and welcome to a podcast focused on the world of corporate real estate and everything that touches it. Today, I'm talking to Alan and Sam Williams, a father and son team who have co-authored a book, which is coming out later this month, with a focus on brand identity, employee engagement, customer experience, all the things that are super important to the world of real estate at the moment and are resonating through the industry. So I'm really pleased to have them on the show. Alan and Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Alan, maybe we kick off with you. And before we get into the meat of this and talk about your book and some other things around business, maybe you can tell us a little bit of your kind of background and journey to this point.
Yeah, sure. So I was raised in a fairly unprivileged environment initially, brought up by a single mother. And I saw that the way out for me was to go to university. I wanted to stretch myself academically, but I wanted a job at the end of it because I knew people that read specialist subjects and then found it a struggle to do anything meaningful afterwards. So I was drawn to the world of business and in particular hotels because I thought they were kind of sexy businesses to be involved in. So I went to university to read hospitality management and moved into that sector and performed operational roles running conference centers, restaurant chains, and eventually I became managing director of a five-star country club resort. Now, while I was there, I used to visit our clients in London in these fantastic flash buildings. But the service was kind of underwhelming, which made me very curious. And so when I looked into this, I found that it was because the services were outsourced, often to a number of different companies. And so there was no common sense of purpose and values across all of those people delivering reception services, security, catering, cleaning, all of that. And so it made me think how interesting it would be to put in place a hotel spirit, service mentality, and delivery model into this corporate workplace environment. And I was lucky because a service provider was looking for that sort of person for a big national Big Four bank. And that's how my experience in workplace started. Then in 2005, I set up Service Brand Global as a consultancy to support organizations using everything that I'd learned in the world of hospitality. And looking back since then, I've worked on six continents, visited more than 30 countries. And at the moment, I'm working with projects in Arizona, in the US, in Hong Kong, Australia, Paris, and this Sunday, I'm working with a group in Egypt, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Lucky you, I guess. Fascinating and obviously very varied background. And come back to that hospitality concept, but you actually reminded me. And I did a podcast maybe 9 months ago with Nick O'Donnell, who runs King's College London, the estate there. And one of the things that he did was brought all their FM back in-house for exactly the reasons you said. Didn't want it with an outsourced provider, but wanted it as front and center, something that King's offered, you know, both the students, but also the public who go onto their campuses. So that may be something we can touch on later. Sam, what about you? Writing a book with your dad, was that an interesting endeavor?
Yeah, it was. So Dad mentioned the idea originally because he wanted to make sure that the book had well-rounded generational perspective. Maybe potentially slightly hesitant at the start to commit to that, just because of kind of what you've mentioned around it being an interesting endeavor to write a book with your dad and go through that process with your dad. But it was interesting to me. So the values economy was something I've grown up in, but for Dad, it was something that he's seen develop and change as the world that we live in has changed. And it was kind of that contrast that I found really interesting. So definitely interesting at times throughout the process, but yeah, really glad we did it.
I'm sure there's a few stories there, but maybe for another time. Okay, so Alan, let's kick off before we get to the book and what that's about with discussion around brand identity. You know, as Sam just said, you know, you grew up with that and you've seen, like I have, that change over time. Let's just do a quick kind of pre-COVID, what was happening in the world of property with this whole idea of brand, both in the hospitality industry that you've mentioned, but also in, you know, with those clients that you might have been visiting who are more traditional office buildings.
Yeah, well, I think to make the point, I'll exaggerate if that's okay. But I think what used to happen, and I don't think this is just a COVID thing, it's that what used to happen is that marketing or brand was something that was kind of created as a theoretical concept and then invested in through the marketing function, through public relations, through advertising, so that message was pumped out into the world and the organization kind of tried to convince as many people of that as it could. That's the way that it worked. So the traditional marketing function was all about persuasion and convincing people. Whereas now, and it's, again, I think this was starting to become evident before COVID. I think the COVID period has kind of made people question what's important to them. And maybe this is receiving more attention as a result of that. But now it's about being true to what you say you stand for. And so it's no longer about the corporate official messaging. It's more about the real felt experience that's being delivered. And that's to all stakeholder groups, not just customers, but to employees, to service partners, to local communities, to investors.
What I find really interesting about what Dad's just said there as well is the shift towards what it's become being because of the lack of control that organizations have over their brand identity now. So as Dad touched on, it used to be something that could be pumped out through marketing and organizations could create an image that they want their consumers to believe, whether that's true or not. Given the world that we live in now, it's just not possible for them to do that. It's not possible for them to be something that they aren't. And that kind of shift of control towards the consumers, I find really interesting because I think it means organizations now have to take a very genuine approach, and there's a lot of difficulties surrounding doing that.
To take it to a very practical level, I like to use examples. And this is, imagine that you, and this would be in post-COVID times, imagine that you go to the pub and you meet somebody and you ask them where they work and they tell you and you say, what's it like working there? Now, what they do not do is go to the official company website and read to you what it says about their organization. They tell you about their felt experience as an employee, and that's what you believe.
I think what you're describing comes a lot from, correct me if I'm wrong, from technology and the fact that there is this sort of shift, as I call it, in the world of corporate real estate, from the employer telling us where we'll work and how we'll work. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean they've said, you know, you come to the office 5 days a week unless you're traveling on business and so on and so forth for most people. And now there seems to be this massive shift to the employee saying, actually, I don't need to come to the office. So if I do, what's going to happen at the office that I can't do at home? And you've mentioned it earlier, Alan, with the hotels example, and we see it more and more in retail. So again, over the last 5-10 years, retail's shifted from being you go to the high street and you walk up and down to something that's more akin to what's described as an experience. So there's experience-driven retail, which is the latest manifestation of retail. And now we're hearing that terminology in the office world. Is that something that you kind of agree with, see? And is it the hotel experience coming to the offices, or is it more than that?
You've touched on this shift of power, which fascinates me because I think it is driven by a number of external forces. But I think there's something also to do with the generations now that are in the workplace and their different psychology and philosophy than our generation, Michael. So, for instance, I remember when I started off in my career, I was kind of scared of my employer. And if an employer asked me to jump, that's what I did. Whereas now people have a much greater sense of themselves and what's important and are not pushed around as easily, I don't think. Sam, is that something you can relate to at your place of work?
Yeah, it is. I think people now are really willing to say what they want, say what they need out of their role, as opposed to necessarily just kind of conforming to what the organization may tell them to do previously. So I think the point, Michael, you touched upon around the shift from hotels to offices being that it's because that the employee has the power now to demand a really strong employee experience if they are going to go to an office. So if employees post-COVID are going to get brought into an office by their organization, they are going to want an experience that creates value in terms of the work that they need to do. So we've seen the development of loads of collaboration tools over the last year, and those companies have boomed because of that. But something that I think organizations are really going to need to focus on now is how they can promote collaboration in their office spaces, because regardless of the tools, there's a certain value in face-to-face collaboration that can only be achieved through being there and being in person. So organizations creating an environment that enables that is going to be really key to bringing employees back to the office and making employees want to come back to the office, I think.
And I think the reason that the hotels parallel is so relevant is, when you think about it, people visit a hotel out of pure choice, and they actually spend money to do that. So what's the parallel in the workplace? Because the employee is no longer a captive audience. You know, they have a choice. And so I believe that the employer needs to create an environment where the employee wants to go there for whatever reason and is willing to do that. And that's where they will be at their best.
Yeah, and I think because previously it used to be mandatory, you used to have to go to the office and it wasn't an option. Whereas now the proposition needs to be attractive, because if the proposition isn't attractive, then employees might not be able to work from home 4 days a week with their current organization, but there will be organizations that are offering that. And if they're not satisfied with what their current employer are offering, then they'll look elsewhere, because enough organizations will probably be looking to move towards providing their employees with a certain experience that meets their needs.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. There's all these new attractions to joining one company over another. So it's they are in competition for talent, and this is now added to that competition. So I can't see companies not offering this massive flexibility change, because it'll be a detriment to their business. If we kind of move into the, and maybe take that conversation into your book, I mean, I'm kind of assuming that all of this change, Alan, is maybe what was driving you to write the book, or maybe it was some other reason. I'd be curious to know. But do you want to just give a quick overview? Sam mentioned earlier the values economy. The title of the book is The Values Economy: How to Deliver Purpose-Driven Service for Sustained Performance. And I'm very interested in the values economy, what you mean by that, and also sustained performance, because that's very much something that corporate real estate teams are started to grapple with.
Yeah, so the book is really broken down into two quite simple parts. The first describes what the values economy is. And in brief, we believe that there are three drivers that have created a new paradigm that we refer to as the values economy. So the first is the way that people are making choices. It used to be that we made choices based on a very rational, often financial basis. You know, what's the best value product or service that I can get for my money? Whereas now people are making choices based on a deeper, more emotional level and what's important to them, or in other words, their values. So I think a great example of this is fair trade. You know, we choose to spend a 15, maybe 20% premium on something because we believe it's right the way that it got to the shelf. That's all. And Sam, you talk about the clothing example, don't you?
Yeah, so just an example from the fast fashion industry would be Pretty Little Thing, who are a fast fashion retailer, recently had a sale. And I think a lot of their items were as cheap as 50p or so. And I think in other times, people would have jumped at that and their sales would have gone through the roof. They would have had really wide exposure in terms of their brand name, and they would have been all over social media. But actually the opposite happened, and there was a massive backlash against it, and you found people questioning how they can price their items at that sort of low level price. And that essentially led to people really questioning the organization in relation to their employee working conditions and other things like that, and had a really negative impact in the end, and led to you seeing the CEO tweeting about it to try and calm everything down, essentially. So I think that example really shows how there's been a bit of a shift around how decisions are made, and it's not as price driven as it has previously been, as people are making more values-based decisions.
And the second C is communication. And this is really fed by the internet and social media, because we can share our point of view to millions of people all over the world in a heartbeat. And the truth gets out a lot faster than it used to be. There's nowhere really to hide. So that's the second C. And then the third C, linked to that, is this whole notion of control of the brand. It used to be that organizations absolutely controlled it, like we were talking about earlier, investing in marketing and advertising and public relations. Whereas now, organizations are no longer what they say they are, but they are what other people say they are. So what their customers say about them, what their employees say about them, what local communities say about them. So those three C's, we refer to it as C to the power of three, because when you join them up, they're extra powerful, they get a turbocharge. That is the new paradigm that we refer to as the values economy. And then the second part of the book describes how you can use the service brand approach, which is really focused on alignment of brand identity, employee engagement, and customer experience to survive and thrive in that new paradigm.
And if we just maybe dig beneath the surface of that, so that's very clear to me. And Sam, again, back to the title of the book, one of the things in the corporate real estate world that people struggle with is understanding how, if you like, different properties may drive different levels of performance for the business. Is that something that you, and I don't necessarily mean just in the real estate sense, but how are you looking at sustained performance in the book as something that comes from these three C's and what Alan's just described?
So I think something to take out of the book in relation to how we talk about sustainability is that in the last section, we talk about sustainability being really important, because if the framework and the approach is implemented on a kind of lip service basis, then it won't necessarily have the impact that we say it can have in the book. So I think it's about an organization's ability to manage their current state, but also looking into their future state as well. So making sure the framework is being implemented now and in the present, but also taking into account how that will sustain the organization's performance through the future. And I think one of the key parts around how it allows organizations to sustain performance is in ensuring that there's alignment across the organization. I think alignment is something really tricky for organizations to achieve, especially massive organizations. And looking across the three areas of the framework, if the right things are in place, so if the different business areas are talking to each other, but they're also bought into the values that the organization promotes, but in a genuine way and in the right way, then that alignment is almost naturally achieved with a lot of effort going into that as well. And that alignment allows organizations to find sustainability in relation to their performance.
And I think this notion of implementing alignment is fascinating, because at one level, it's very simple and easy to understand, but then it's really difficult to achieve on an ongoing basis. And let me give you another practical example. I worked for an investment bank, and their marketing people had come up with this strap line which said, XYZ, the company name, people are fitter. That was it. And at Canary Wharf Underground Station in London, they had these massive banners as high as a building, just with this simple statement, XYZ company people are fitter. Now, at the same time, human resources had put in place, you know, the ride a bike to work scheme, where you basically get a tax break if you want to buy a bicycle. But in communicating this to the workforce, the employees, they did not mention XYZ Limited, people are fitter. What a missed opportunity. And then, Michael, you'll relate to this, they hadn't consulted with the people in the facilities management function, and so there were no bike racks at their place of work. So if you had invested in one of these bicycles, you had nowhere to park it safely. Now, imagine if they had used the service brand approach, where you've got alignment across marketing, human resources, and customer service delivery, what would happen is HR would be banging the drum saying, we've got this bike scheme all sorted out because our people are fitter. You've got these fantastic bike racks in the underground or basement car park. You've got showering facilities so you can get smart for work before you arrive at your desk. And maybe when you park your back on the wall at the back of the bike racks, there's a sign saying XYZ people are fitter, all reinforcing at very little extra cost, but creating enormous value.
I am laughing because I think it's a strange strap line, but that's a conversation for another time probably, but whether they work. But one of the things, another good example, you have a number of case studies effectively in the book. One of them is Wimbledon, and I wanted to just touch on that. But you know, there's this quote which you take from Steve Cannon, which says, customer experience is the new marketing. And I'm sure that's embedded in the Wimbledon case study. So maybe the two of you can bring that to life. Why did you pick Wimbledon and sort of the parallels in the business world?
Yeah, I've admired Wimbledon service delivery for decades. So when I was in my final year at university, we had the chance to go and work there, basically supervising the hospitality service delivery in a marquee. And I was just bowled over by the way everything fitted the brand in terms of delivery, from the colour of the flowers to the uniforms to the politeness of everybody that worked there. And it was strange, Sam, wasn't it? Because there was a gap of something like 20 odd years between the first time I went there and the first time Sam went there. But Sam, tell us about your first experience.
Yeah, so I think we had very, very similar experiences. So I think Dad asked me the question, when did you first go to Wimbledon and what was your experience? What was your take? So I first went in 2010. And I think our experiences were really similar just because of the consistency that they've delivered in terms of their brand identity for years and years now. So whether it's looking into the really small details as to the fact that there's a tennis court on the train station platform at Wimbledon, themed flowers en route to the venue when you're walking there, and two, when you arrive, you see the beautiful grounds, very minimal branding, and also their employees all are extremely polite, extremely consistent in the way that they manage you when you arrive there, the way that they go about handling you. And I think your experience was really similar, Dad.
Yeah, that's right. And so mine was 1982. So it's actually a gap of some 30 years, right? And yet we experienced something very similar. And, you know, hats off to Wimbledon to be able, that is sustained performance. And the point here is that, just like the Steve Cannon quote, this is about people going to Wimbledon, talking like we're talking now, and other people hearing that and feeling, I want to go there. This is not about Wimbledon kind of creating an advertising campaign saying, we're wonderful, you should come.
And I think just to finally add to that, it's interesting. If you talk to someone about Wimbledon, one of the first things they might say to you is strawberries and cream or Pimm's. And that's not because they've seen a TV advert of Wimbledon with those things in. It's not because the marketing team have pushed those out. They've become linked to Wimbledon intrinsically just because that's the perception that everyone has of the event. And I think that's created through their consistency in delivery that Dad's mentioned.
Yeah, and as you say, I guess that they're very aware that there's a massive TV audience as well as obviously a live one. And, you know, if you're not fortunate enough to go and you're watching it on the TV, and I mean, some of the TV coverage cuts to all of that. And so it sort of reinforces the brand, even though they're not, the TV channels aren't paid to advertise Wimbledon. So it's not interesting, you know, they're playing the media at its own game in a way and using that to build its brand without having to pay for it, which I think is really clever. And it's thinking of these different ways of bringing that to whatever it is that you're selling or what business you're in.
I was just going to say that's another aspect of Wimbledon that I really admire, how they have managed to combine this kind of tradition and heritage, but also maintaining relevance in a dynamic world. So they've brought all of their broadcasting in-house to control it, and they've grown their social media like Topsy over the last 5 years. And it's now become one of the most viewed sporting events in the world, whereas 5 years ago, that was not the case.
Yeah, fascinating. And long may that last. Okay, so maybe just to sort of wrap it up, you've talked about the book and the case studies. You've gone through this idea of these three key areas: choice, communication, control. If I just bring it back maybe to wrap up to your kind of views on property, you know, we're in this sort of, I was going to say no man's land, but we're right in that point, inflection point, where everyone's thinking, okay, towards the end of this year, I'm talking Europe and the US, because I guess Asia, a lot of Asia is back to work and more or less. But we're now, as an industry, as a business, people are saying, what should we do when we go back to work? Because that's now imminent, might be third, fourth quarter this year, let's say, and into next year. So those plans have to be made now. Alan, if I start with you, what are the one or two things you kind of implore businesses to be thinking about that they might not around this topic that you think will help, you know, people want to go back to a physical office space because it's beneficial to them as the employee?
Yeah, I think that the thing that I would advise them to do is remember that place is not the key question. The key question is, how can we enable the business? And that might look different from one business or one geography to another, but that's the key question. So, you know, if you think about it at a strategic level, I remember working for an organization and that we were approaching a year in which they were really focused on sales. And because of that, it meant that they were going to be entertaining a lot of people in their premises. But what they didn't do is talk to corporate real estate services about freeing up some space, more space, in which they could provide that entertainment and hospitality. Why not? Secondly, at a management level, it's really, for me, about the alignment of corporate real estate services and FM with other relevant functions like human resources and IT. You know, instead of operating in silos, guys, get together and ask yourselves the question, how can we collectively enable the business? And then at a delivery level, there are simple things like asking the question, how can our supply chain live our organizational values in delivering service to our employees when they're in the office? Why would you not do that? And yet it's often overlooked.
For me, I think the key thing is flexibility. I don't think organizations that are demanding 5 days a week from employees in the office will have success. But then on the other hand, there are still people that want to go to an office. So I think organizations will need to find a middle ground between providing the opportunity to work from home for those that want to work from home, but also still having office space for their employees to go to collaborate, not even necessarily to collaborate, to work in an independent basis, just because they think they're more productive in an office than they are working from home. So whether that looks like reducing office space by 40%, for example, so you're allowing people to still have a space to go to, but are also giving people the freedom of working from home. But I think for me, it's that flexible approach that is key to making sure you're meeting the needs of all employees, really.
Great. All right. I think we need to wrap it up there. Sam and Alan, fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your time and insights. And most importantly, best of luck with the book launch later this month. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks very much for having us, Michael. Great to chat.